This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast with Hilary Angelo and Isabel Angelovsky, and me, Maze Jaffari, the host of this episode. In our episode today about green cities and contemporary climate planning practices and politics, we're discussing the greening cities and contemporary climate policies, their limitations, consequences, particularly in post-industrial regions and cities in transformation. And later we will be discussing the intersections of race, gender, ethnicity, and socially greening and the climate policies. Finally, we will talk about the impact of COVID-19 on people's use of nature, as well as government's approaches of green infrastructure. So we will start with a short introduction about yourselves, Hilary and Isabel. So please briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Mace. I can start. My name is Hilary Angelo, and I'm an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I study, among other things, urban greening, urban sustainability planning, and contemporary climate policy. But as a sociologist, I do so from a kind of social scientific and social theoretical perspective. So a lot of my work is focused on the ideas about nature that drive our interventions in cities. And before I became an academic, I used to work for the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation, where a lot of my interests in these questions came from.
Thank you, Mace, for hosting us. So I have a background in urban studies and planning. I'm originally from France, but got my PhD at MIT, then came back to Europe around 10 years ago in 2011. And now I'm a Nigrea research professor at one of the public universities in Barcelona, which is the Autonomous University of Barcelona. And I'm also the director of the Barcelona Lab for Urban Environmental Justice and Sustainability, which is a engaged research lab that starts from the premise of doing critical sustainability studies, starting with a strong social inequality lens and with a lot of interest from our community of researchers in critical public health, geography, sociology, social movements, and mobilization for just green cities, and then also a study of all of the policies and practices that can lead us to more justice as cities engage in this greening route, let's say.
So for the audience, I'll introduce myself. I am Maze Jaffari, and I work at the TU Dortmund University as a research scientist, where I finished my PhD from. And I research public spaces and the perception of public spaces in different contexts. And I'm happy to have you here in our episode today. So first, congratulations, Hilary, on your wonderful new book about how green became good. And in your book, you examine and will document urban greening in the Ruhr region in Germany across three moments in its contemporary history, from industrialization in the late 19th century to post-war democratic ideals in the 1960s, and to industrial decline and economic and urban renewal in the early 90s. You also argue that turning off neglected formal industrial sites into urban greening projects is not just a physical transformation, but rather a social development in which social practices are driven by social imaginaries. So that brings me to a fundamental question in our episode for you both, Hilary and Isabel. So why nature is good, and what the value it adds socially and environmentally? So why green is important to people, and what do you think the value associated with it?
I'll go first. Thanks for mentioning the book, Mais. Yeah, so this book just came out. It's called How Green Became Good. The questions that were motivating it are very similar to the ones that you just raised. And the goal of the book was to try to provide a sort of historical and critical perspective on the contemporary green city or contemporary greening. And I think, you know, we tend to assume today, or many sort of practitioners go about their greening projects today, assuming that green is good. And as a sociologist and as a sort of historical sociologist, the question that I was interested in is, where do these ideas come from? And, you know, can we trace their history? And can we then, from that, better understand the kinds of assumptions that people are operating with when they use them to transform the built environment? So you asked, I guess, you know, what values does nature add, or why is green good? And so I think the kind of one of the questions that I try to ask is, how does green become good? Where do we learn to think about it in these ways? And what does it then enable us to do? And one of the historical transformations I look at in the book, or that I make an argument about, is a kind of moment in the 19th century, though this sort of arrival of this moment varied in places, different places and times, but a sort of transition from seeing nature as a good that was useful for like subsistence purposes or other kind of material benefits, right? The nature as a food source, to the way we tend to think about nature today in these greening projects, where nature becomes more, a much more kind of moral or affective good. So something that's understood to be, you know, socially beneficial or improve quality of life in cities.
Oh, thank you. So what do you think, Isabel? So what's the value nature brings to people?
So I really like Hillary's historic perspective, because it seems that, you know, now you have all of these cities that are competing to be the greenest, the most livable cities around the world. But then we cannot forget that the whole greening movement, the whole hygienization movement of cities, you know, started in the 19th century with the acute industrialization of our urban areas. So I really like that perspective. What we are really also seeing now is kind of a revival of the idea that green is beneficial. And I think it kind of comes from maybe two, three different contexts. One, which is the public health, the environmental epidemiology research, and then applied, let's say, policy, where greening decreases your mortality risk. For example, greening is known to decrease all risks of mortality by 8%. You also know that greening helps to address air pollution, filtrates particulate matter, although sometimes it also can create new allergies. So anyway, there are always some trade-offs about how to green cities in ways that can improve health without creating other health impacts. But anyway, so there's a whole movement to address air pollution for health reasons and for the relationship between pollution and respiratory diseases, cancers, and others. And then that's all linked to improved mobility, so more sustainable mobility, more active mobility in cities, and again, kind of a wholesome vision for a healthy city for everyone. Then you also have the whole climate, biodiversity, ecology community, which really sees greening as a way to both address mitigation needs. So, for example, the need to reforest eroded areas or areas that could be more exposed to wildfires, for example. And then you also have greening in the perspective of climate adaptation. And so adapting to sea level rise, to increased risk of flooding. And so the whole green resilient infrastructure movement that we see. And then finally, there's also the whole economic argument now that cities have really jumped on, because green sells for new real estate projects. It sells a new image of the city. It's a form of branding to attract the creative class, like Austin did very well. Austin in Texas did very well for this. Nantes in France did also very well when it closed its shipyard industry in the 1990s, at the very beginning of the 1990s. It really engaged in a huge green and blue wave of just creating green everywhere. And so now it's known as the city of 100 gardens. And it's also known as this new metropolis in France. And it was a city that originally only had like 200,000 residents, but now it has positioned itself nationally as the place to go if you don't want to live in Paris. And so I think that economic argument is very powerful because it also justifies all of the more costly arguments that, costly investment that climate adaptation, for example, requires. So there is a benefit for it.
Thank you, Isabel. So you just mentioned a wide range of benefits from interacting with nature. So do you think that all people benefit equally from urban green spaces and all people have equal access to urbanized nature with all these benefits you just mentioned?
No, and if that's a follow-up question to what you're asking before, I'm happy to answer first, but absolutely not at all. And I think there are really two moments there, which is that there is a historic legacy of unequal access to nature by race, ethnicity, and class. You see it in the US, you see it in Canada, or in Europe, in Germany, for example. The areas in Berlin that have the least amount of green space are areas where a higher percentage of working class residents and racialized immigrant communities are living. And that's a repetition that you see in every other city. And so that's from a deep legacy, for example, in the US, coming from racial segregation, white flight to the suburbs, disinvestment from urban cores, that all happened in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and that kind of brought urban centers to a point where more, you know, working class and racialized communities were living in areas that were not green, that didn't have access to nature. And that, you know, contrasted with other areas of the city that were more peripheral, that tended to have greater access to trees, parks, etc. And then now you have kind of a second wave, which is, okay, so first of all, cities are trying, at least those that claim to start from an equity lens or put equity at the center, try to address that legacy of lack of access to green space. And places like Philadelphia, Baltimore put a lot of emphasis on this, Boston. But then you now have also a process that Hillary and I study, which is, and others, that's called green gentrification, where you see that areas that have been greened over the last 10, 15 years or so. So it's kind of a new wave, if you will, of city revitalization via greening, are now seeing greater investment in real estate properties that are luxury real estate, land speculation, move-in of residents from higher classes, from higher income, and wider backgrounds. And this process, I'm simplifying, then creating higher cost of living and then displacement of marginalized groups. And so there is no access that's equal to nature, because those groups that actually were living or originally, let's say, you know, 30 years ago in neighborhoods that were industrial and deprived, then started to benefit from greening, and then now they have to be displaced. So it's kind of this double, in a way, double injustice.
Okay, so thank you for your answer. So you mean in the contemporary climate planning and the policies, these issues are not considered in the planning. So gentrification, higher cost of living, displacement, social equity. So do you still think that people don't have equal access to these, to nature? Although it's just nature. It's like it's not built environment. So what do you think about that? And maybe Hillary, you will tell us about your opinion in that. And so who's included in the policies of contemporary climate planning and who's left out, and what the consequences of these policies? So if you have to comment about that first, Isabel, and if you have no comments, maybe Hillary can start with her answer.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear Hillary's thoughts too. I've extended myself way too much.
thank you.
And actually, so I'm happy to respond to that. And maybe before we get into contemporary climate planning, I'd just like to add a few things to Isabel's response to your previous question about whether everyone benefits equally. So I completely agree with everything that Isabel said, and I just add a couple of things to it. So I mentioned before that in the book, one of the things I'm interested in historically is a kind of shift in the way we think about nature from a sort of subsistence or material good to something that is seen to have kind of moral and effective benefits. One of the things that I think comes along with that idea, and this is, like, there are aspects of the ways we think about nature that have a really long history. So one of the things that I think is there's a kind of romantic idea of nature that grows out of the Enlightenment, a kind of European and American tradition, an idea of an external nature as being outside of society. And one of the things that I argue comes along with that is an idea of nature as sort of, or green space as benefiting everyone equally, right? The idea being that if it kind of stands outside of human divisions, that we can all benefit from its access, from access to it in more or less the same way. So kind of translated into contemporary planning and policy, you end up with a discourse sort of like the following. Well, if we put in a park, you know, all that really needs to be done is to provide sort of physical access to it. So if everyone can get to a green space, then that kind of meets the democratic mandate and allows nature to do all these wonderful things that it does, improve public health, and improve economic outcomes and all the things that Isabel was mentioning. So I think one of the challenges of that is that when we think about sort of the politics of urban nature and urban greening, too often the conversation even just stops at the level of access, right? So we think a lot about kind of democratizing green cities in terms of physical access. But one of the things that I think the kind of legacy of these sorts of racial and ethnic geographies that Isabel was mentioning is that there's also a whole layer of kind of sort of cultural access, I guess you could say, that has to do with the way these spaces are designed, what kinds of activities and behaviors are seen to be, expected or available to people in them. So I think that's just one other way that people don't benefit equally from greening projects. So the sort of layer of physical access, but also kind of cultural or social access. The other thing I was going to say is just that this idea, I think, allows us to kind of carry out greening as a public good. So too often, again, we sort of think that these projects can be a kind of cure-all for all kinds of social problems and don't always think about some of these differences.
I have a question to what you said about the access, mm-hmm. whether it's social access or physical access. So do you think the design of a park or a public space is the determining factor of the access or the gender access, for example, or the cultural dynamics and the culture of a society?
Yeah, I think I'm not a designer, of course, but I think, you know, in terms of the design questions that I would ask of designers, right? So there's a sort of level that's about location. There's a level about the sort of physical design of a park I mentioned, or a green space. I used to work for the Parks Department. So, you know, thinking about sort of multi-use spaces and so on, I think is important. When I was working at parks, there was at the time, this is in New York City, the Department of Parks and Recreation, what was called a language access initiative that was coming down from the mayor's office. And basically the city was being asked to better serve new immigrants in all of its city agencies. And so in the Parks Department, again, this raised all these questions about, like, what did access to nature actually mean? Was it about physical access? Language access usually relates to, like, translating signage or translating rules into other languages. And so the sort of Parks Department, the city agency, sort of initially thought that, all we need to do is, you know, translate this sign that says, please put your litter in the trash can, into more languages. But I think part of the work that I did there was to, with my coworkers at the time, was to try to, like, help expand the conversation beyond these questions of signage and kind of physical access to some of these more Yeah. Ideas about use and users.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I ask this because in my research or traveling, observing public spaces in Jordan, in the US, in Germany, and in Iran recently, like design can play a minor role in determining the access. Sometimes the culture, the dynamics, the cultural codes, they're more determining the who's accessing the space. So I was interested to know what you think about it, at least in the US context.
Let me just say one more thing. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, one thing that I guess I would also add, like something that I try to do in my work, again, as a sort of historical sociologist and not a planner or a designer or even a very policy-oriented scholar in a direct sense, is to try to disentangle some of these dynamics that seem to me to be really bound up in the current political economy, right? So these like dynamics of green gentrification that Isabel was mentioning before, with some trends and patterns and questions that we might ask in greening projects that actually have a much longer history and that you can see playing out in really different places in really different ways, including at really different time periods. So, nature's ideas, public health benefits has a long history, certainly going back to the 19th century in the US and Europe, which are the contexts I know best. Some of these questions about, what makes these spaces accessible and what can people be doing in them, right? In New York City's Central Park in the 19th century, it was supposed to be for sort of, promenading and riding around in your carriage for wealthy New Yorkers and learning how to become a cultured and wealthy New Yorker if you weren't one of those people who had a carriage yourself. But there were all kinds of, lots of things that you weren't supposed to be doing in that park. So all that's true today and elsewhere.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So back to the point you mentioned, Isabel, about the benefits of climate and climate-related planning. So what does this all mean in the context of contemporary climate policy, what we just mentioned, all the aspects? And what do you think, what changes is the climate crisis prompting?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because nowadays, like in the European Union where I live, there's this whole new vocabulary of nature-based solutions, NBS, that the European Commission has promoted for cities to engage with, and then researchers as well. So, we are here doing research with cities about how to reintegrate nature in the city. But the way that the EU is thinking about it is, okay, bring nature back in and it will solve every single problem. And one of them is actually, it will also create jobs and create economic growth. And so there's a complete disconnect. There's a complete dissonance between what political institutions like the EU are aiming to achieve, which is both climate adaptation and climate mitigation. And then the type of rhetoric that still promotes massive use of resources and a very predatory type of economy, like basically economic growth, which has been proven to be one of the main causes of carbon emissions and then of waste creation and of the climate crisis. But nature is supposed to solve all of this. And so there is really a huge disconnect, a huge dissonance there between the goals, the vision that is being sold, and in the end, the capacity of those nature-based solutions to address the deep climate emergency that we are faced with. So that's one thing. On the other hand, you can see that some cities are really being bold with approaches that actually are also aiming to address climate needs. So for example, sea level rise, extreme flooding, droughts, heat island effects, and they are using greening in ways that can be also empowering both for urban residents, for civic organizations that work around greening, and then at the same time that have other goals that are, for example, caring cities or the city of care, or cities that are built around also the solidarity in the social economy. And so Barcelona, for example, is one of those cases where the mayor, Ada Colau, declared a climate emergency in January 2020. And since then has, or actually even a little bit before, has promoted a system of super blocks, which are those 3x3 pacified blocks of traffic, where streets are made to be gained back for residents, for bikes, rather than for cars. And there are supposed to be actually 500 of them dispersed through the entire city, where by the end, let's say, of this entire vision and project realization, you would really decrease car traffic, car dependence by, I forgot the numbers, but by, let's say, a very substantial number. Residents would gain their streets back, and then within those 3x3 blocks, new green spaces and new nature would be, is already being built to address flooding, urban heat island effects, etc. And then what the mayor is also adding is meaning to have those super blocks as kind of the logic of the 15-minute city, or what Barcelona calls the super blocks of care, meaning that everything that citizens who need care, who are part of a caring city, and also in general a city for women who need way more self-care practices than they have been able to give themselves and society has given themselves, those super blocks are also creating these networks of care with schools, daycares, places for the elderly as well, socialization and day centers for the elderly, together with, let's say, also an economy around care. And so that could be really quite powerful at the same time as the city, especially Barcelona, is trying to address a long-term dependence on mass tourism. And so kind of thinking about a different development model that is much less resource consumption and waste driven. So you have potentials there, but you also have cities that are just, again, as I was saying at the beginning, engaging in this green route as one new kind of wave of competitive urbanism between one another to basically attract, you know, investment and industries, rather than really think deeply about the climate costs of their action.
Thank you for your insight in this. So apart from the limitation of nature-based solutions, what do you think about the social aspect of it, the co-creation, co-implementation, and co-management? So what do you think about that?
I'll respond quickly, and then I'm interested in hearing Hilary as well. What we've been seeing with nature-based solutions is that, at least those that are used towards climate adaptation, is that you see also a form of gentrification via what's now known as climate gentrification, meaning that the areas that are greener, that have this kind of green resilient infrastructure everywhere, are now being capitalized upon by higher income residents who are able to be the one moving into those kind of islands of resilience or citadels of resilience, while others are having to move, residents of color, more vulnerable residents, are having to move to lower grounds, to much more exposed areas, because those are the only areas that they are able to live in. You see that in Boston, for example. Boston has a huge plan called the Boston Harbor Plan that is meant to literally green the entire coastline and waterfront of Boston. You're talking here about 70 miles or 60 miles of waterfront. So it's huge and it encompasses a lot of neighborhoods. But those neighborhoods are also where working class residents have lived for decades, and now they completely feel pushed away by kind of the entire greening of the waterfront that has really accelerated a form of gentrification that was maybe more nascent, that was already present. But greening is just kind of boosting the entire process. And so you have a lot of social inequality, racial inequality that's being recreated, but that Boston Harbor Plan without enough safeguards at all to protect residents from displacement.
Thank you. So what do you think, Hilary, about the contemporary climate and greening policies?
Well, I would say, so another layer that I would just add to what's already been said. So we've been talking today about urban greening, and as Isabel kind of mentioned at the beginning, this is a sort of ubiquitous policy term that can refer to all kinds of things. So we're talking sometimes about climate adaptation and mitigation efforts, sometimes these more kinds of, you know, everyday forms of adding parks and trees and things to cities. It's carried out with the rationales related to climate change, public health, quality of life, economic development, all kinds of things. Something that I think is particularly interesting about all this and that really matters in the context of climate planning is the kind of power of particular green representations of nature. So as most listeners of this podcast probably know, thinking about sort of how to best intervene in cities and other built environments for climate change doesn't always look like green stuff, right? Often it's about investments in denser or more affordable housing close to transit, public transit, and so on. But something that I talk about in the book and in also some of my other work is about the sort of the bias towards green in many climate planning, climate interventions that we see today. So there's a set of kind of representations of nature that are ubiquitous. If you see, you know, architects and designers who make kind of green and sustainable apartment buildings, there will always be sort of ivy or plants on the exterior of those buildings, right? And that's a way, a kind of aesthetic way, a visible signifier for those of us who are looking at these things to understand their kind of sustainability content. So that's a kind of very aesthetic version, but I think you also see it in, for example, climate planning. So I've been doing some work with some colleagues here in California. We've been looking at California cities' climate action plans. So those are kind of planning documents that cities here often produce that sort of say what they're going to do, what kind of action they're going to take on climate change. And so we found that we're looking specifically at how equity is conceived, but it's true more generally. We found that that equity tends to look green. So the paper that we're working on is called Missing the Housing for the Trees. We find that these plans have much more kind of, you know, visibly or aesthetically or recognizably green interventions in the form of open space trees and so on, and much less of an emphasis on what you might call gray or more sort of systemic or sometimes even redistributive interventions in the built environment related to things like transit, jobs, and housing. And we think part of the reason for that is that these types of interventions are sort of traditionally less recognizable as environmental goals. And I think, so in terms of the sort of ubiquity of this set of representations and therefore this kind of the set of policy interventions that follow, you can also see it when you think about kind of climate planning internationally. So regardless of the kind of local ecology of specific places or the sort of local environmental needs, often you'll see that sort of adaptation and mitigation schemes again kind of emphasize things like trees, things like the sort of natural, apparently natural parts of the built environment that may not kind of match the local ecology or local social and economic needs. So anyway, that's just another thing that I think we should be attentive to in these projects.
Thank you for your answer. So I have a question about the planning, climate planning, green planning. So in the light of the current situation related to the coronavirus, so how do your argument fit with the COVID-19 reevaluation that the use and appreciation of nature in people's life has increased? Do you agree on that? And what do you think about that? Maybe you can tell us what you think about this, Isabel.
No, I mean, this is a really important question and a really important strategy that cities have engaged into since COVID-19, like, you know, greater construction of bike lanes and anything related to more sustainable and active mobility, revitalization or expansion of parks and green areas, street being cut from traffic. You see that everywhere. I don't even need to cite names: San Francisco, Milan, Paris, Barcelona. Again, I mean, Washington. I mean, this is just impressive what some cities have been able to manage in terms of the space gained away from cars, which again has huge climate impacts as well, in addition to giving people greater access during confinement to at least have some space to be safely outside and protect yourself from infection. But that doesn't mean that, again, going back to my general emphasis on justice and equity, that it's done in a way that is accessible and benefiting everyone. Like if we think about, for example, the need of essential workers to commute to work every day and who haven't been able to telework at home and be there safely, they're much more depend than white collar workers on public transit or even on their cars. And so biking is really fantastic if you live within, you know, 5, 3, 5, 10 kilometers of your work, and you have really a flat city and it's really easy access, but many cities are not like that. And so you have a wonderful new bike infrastructure and public space infrastructure within the city center, but that really doesn't necessarily bode well and is not accessible again to those essential workers, which in many cases are feminized workers, people from more socially vulnerable backgrounds. And so again, you have a kind of a social and racial inequity being reproduced there. And I really liked what Hillary said before in terms of the design, the visual, the graphics, like cities now have all of these really incredible tactical urbanism projections of themselves, you know, everywhere in the media, on Twitter and all of it. But if you dig a little bit more, you also realize that that again, not everyone has the ability to benefit from them. And then the timing that exists to make those changes permanent is actually quite short, because the car lobby is very powerful in many cities. And so, you know, those industries can strike back very quickly in their demand for getting rid of all of the tactical urbanism measures that have made cities more, more livable, maybe somewhat livable under COVID. And I already see it in my own city of Barcelona. The car traffic has actually increased tremendously again, but just somehow in different ways than it used to, in the sense that you have areas that remain pacified and do not have as many cars as before, because all of the constraints that the cities has put in place, the obstacles, the physical obstacles, have made some areas really protected from traffic. But then you have entire neighborhoods that haven't been touched, or entire avenues and boulevards that remain, and that actually more than before are very heavily car intensive. And then now with kind of deconfinement everywhere in Europe, people are not necessarily going back to they are going back to work, but they are not necessarily going back to public transit. They are still taking their cars. And so I think that this climate crisis is not going anywhere, unfortunately, at all. And so cities really need to take many more bold measures to address it.
Yeah, thank you. The discussion on this is indeed controversial. On one side, you see people using bicycles and walking, but on the other side, people are not using public transit as before. They're using their private cars, and this is, of course, adding to the climate crisis. So what do you think, Hillary? What do you think about COVID-19 situation and what's its impact on nature and both on nature and people's lives towards nature?
I think it has certainly raised people's awareness, if even possible or necessary. Somehow it's really, you know, made people be even more aware of the kind of value of access to nature in daily lives, which is an important thing, even though, you know, I was saying sort of all the things we need to think critically about nature at the beginning, but there's also, you know, yeah, this is true as well. But anyway, in addition to that, I think it's also, of course, both in the form of access, who has access to open space, and even, you know, who has been disproportionately exposed to this other form of nature in COVID-19 has really highlighted kind of how deeply intertwined class, race, ethnicity, the built environment, all of these kinds of social factors are in any kind of all the ways that we have to think about the environment in our lives. But more importantly, so I think another piece about all this has to do with this movement of urbanites to rural and peri-urban spaces. So I live in Santa Cruz, which is part of the Bay Area region, so kind of near Silicon Valley and near the tech economy and near San Francisco, which I think along with New York City is one of only two cities in the United States where rents have fallen this year or something. There's been a kind of mass exodus of people out to the hinterland. So people buying second homes, who can afford it, people who can work from home, such as tech professionals, buying houses in places like Santa Cruz where I live. So this has had a huge impact on housing prices in the Bay Area region, including here where I live. And so that is certainly on people's minds at the moment. And, you know, I personally think that the sort of worries that there will not be a return to these kinds of cities is probably overstated, but certainly there's an impact on housing prices in these regions. And it is certainly the case that people who are moving into them have kind of expectations in terms of infrastructure and services. And so that's something that all of these regions are contending with right now. So I think there's just a sort of question mark in terms of what the geography of work and home and commuting patterns looks like in the future, as well as all of the kind of infrastructure questions that come along with that in terms of internet access, roads, how many of them we need, how much of that space we can turn over to pedestrians and bicyclists, as Isabel was saying, and who gets to benefit from those kinds of geographies, right? Who can work from home and that kind of thing, and who's going to have to continue relying on public transit and that sort of thing. So I'd say a lot of open questions at
yeah.
all scales.
Yeah, you're indeed right about the aspects of digitalization, mobility. They're definitely decisive in how the development is progressing in that term. We see in Dortmund and in the planning of the Ruhr region that the perception of the city is changing, like what's meant to be urban or urbanized. So people are moving to the periphery of the city, and definitely this will impact the planning these areas and the periphery of the city and the interplay between the urban centers and the outskirts of the city. Now I'd like to close our episode with talking about the promising directions for the future. So what positive changes or negative do you see, but hopefully positive, do you see in the context of climate and the green politics and policies? So maybe we can start with you, Isabel.
What positive do I see? Again, going back from my point of view of equity right now, it's hard to think about it because in some ways, like, you know, this kind of double legacy or constant form of land and resource appropriation that working class communities have faced since urban renewal and before, you know, since slavery in the US is still very much imprinting urban planning and urban development in a lot of US cities. And here in Europe, what I see a lot in terms of exclusion and very strong precarization of immigrant communities in the context and their increased vulnerabilization to the climate crisis makes it difficult for me to have always, you know, positive thoughts about it. I want to be hopeful that COVID is a form of alarm in a lot of city makers, public officials that did not even have any form of sensibility to issues related to nature, to climate needs, to quality of life. But on the other hand, what I'm seeing is that actually many cities have that conscious. So, you know, you're not in 2005, where there was maybe a much smaller amount of cities engaged into urban sustainability, urban planning. Now every city around the planet, you know, seems to want to promote itself as the green and climate resilient, and you name it. It's greening is a form of planning orthodoxy, and it has reached many contours and many places in the global south as well. And so I think the discourse or the intentions are there. But as I said in one of my recent articles, intentions are not enough. Being intentional in greening or being intentional in justice is not enough, especially so if your city is built on a model of urban development that is land intensive, that is very much driven by, in the US, for example, property taxes and the ways in which developers bring those property taxes and construction. Constant construction is a way to attract different types of residents with a higher purchasing power and then a higher capacity to buy and to pay taxes, to pay property taxes. And so I think that this economic model, this budgetary dependence, if you will, on a form of resource intensive and exclusionary development is not permitting authorities to be as bold so far as is really needed to both adapt to climate impacts and mitigate mitigate carbon emissions. And so for me, that's really, it's really difficult so far to see an example of city that is not really embedded into those logics of capital intensive development and exclusion.
Thank you. What about you, Hillary?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I like this phrase, greening is planning orthodoxy. So yeah, greening has become planning orthodoxy. That still leaves a whole lot of questions about what that means and how it should be carried out. And these kind of pro-growth and capital-centric models. And I mean, I would say like, and kind of often equity blind or sort of taking this term in pretty simple ways are certainly not going to be sufficient. I think in my own work, since I was emphasizing before this kind of orientation toward green aesthetics and representational forms in these forms of planning, regardless of the kind of ecological or social needs of a particular city or community, I think maybe we're seeing a bit of a shift towards more gray kinds of interventions, or interventions that are more oriented or increasingly oriented towards things like housing, jobs, transit, and the built environment, that are, as I said, like often more systemic and sometimes even more distributive, like redistributive than others. I mentioned that I've been studying these climate action plans and specifically how they think about equity, and the vast, vast majority of them continue to think about it in terms of trees. But we have seen a trend, a slight shift in the number of these climate action plans that are dealing with affordable housing in particular. And I think also, and this is something that I've really come to be even more aware of recently as I've started to talk about my new book. So the book also uses this phrase of a social imaginary of nature. So it's interested in this idea of nature as, you know, green in form, as presumed to be universal, as presumed to be socially beneficial, that I really argue has been dominant in planning and politics for the last 150 years. And many young audience members, current undergraduates and graduate students, have said to me that they feel that there are social movements, right, housing movements, climate justice movements, and so on, that actually have a really excellent analysis of the problems with this kind of, you know, this rather simplistic and generally pro-growth conception, and that you're seeing arguments being made for things like affordable housing, things like investments in public transit, as ecological goals. And so I think that that shift in social movements and in sort of potentially policy understandings or sort of practical understandings of these concepts is a change when you think about it in the context of the last 150 years or so, and one that hopefully we'll begin to see in more kind of mainstream and technocratic planning efforts at a larger scale.
Thank you, Hilary, for the last words. As you just talked about shift in social movements, and earlier in your book, that special transformation in the Ruhr region has been induced by social change and activism. I support this argument, and I believe that change also starts within us, and we people are the drivers of change towards sustainable and environmentally conscious behavior. And so we people should also act green or behave green towards the built and natural environment. Towards the end of our episode, I'd like to thank you, Isabel and Hilary, very much for being here today and for your views and insights on the various topics we discussed. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the podcast of Urban Political and to our today's episode about green cities and contemporary climate planning practices and politics with Hilary Angelo and Isabel Angelovsky and me, the host, Maize Jaffari. That's all for today, and thank you very much.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.